Well, as we continue our study this morning of the unfolding of God's redemptive plan in the Old Testament, turn with me to Genesis chapter 33. Genesis chapter 33. Just to set this up for us this morning, let me remind you that up to this point, Jacob has been in full-fledged panic mode. Not only is his long-estranged brother Esau coming to meet him, but he's coming with 400 of his men, which in Jacob's mind can mean only one thing. Esau's coming to kill him and to take everything that he owns in hopes that he might placate his brother. You'll recall that Jacob sent Esau a gift, or better, a bribe, of 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes, 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys, and 10 male donkeys in a further attempt to placate his brother. The servants delivering these animals were to convey to Esau that they were being delivered by Esau's servant. Another indication of Jacob's fear of his brother's intentions. In our last study, we talked about Jacob's wrestling with the Lord in hopes of securing his blessing, an event that not only resulted in his receiving a new name, which is Israel, but also no doubt strengthened him and emboldened him considerably. Now, just how significantly did this affect Jacob? Well, in reality, it didn't really affect him immediately to a great extent, at least in terms of alleviating his fears. Now, how do we know that? Well, read with me beginning at verse 1, and then as usual, I'll be making any necessary comments along the way. Moses writes here, "Then Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. He put the maids and their children in front, and Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground 7 times until he came near his brother." Way to go, Jacob. How brave of you to put all of the women and children in the front. How brave of you to rank order them in order of the amount of love that you had for each of them. How brave of you then to walk on ahead, which was somewhat brave, but look how he did it. He walks ahead of them and almost every step of the way, he's bowing down. He's bowing down as the servant of his brother Esau. Now, as I said last week, had Jacob fully believed the Lord and trusted him as he should have, he very well could have marched up to Esau and announced that he had returned, and he could have done that with absolutely zero fear of anything happening to him. But instead, what does he do? Again, he divides everybody up, further demonstrating his paranoia at this point, his fear at this point. Most commentators agree, as I just said, that he arranged these groups of individuals in rank order according to their preciousness to him. And then he went ahead of them, bowing to the ground 7 times until he came near his brother. Now, what's up with this bowing down? Well, this was something that an abject slave would do in approaching their master. This is something that someone at the lowest possible rung of society would do when meeting the king. He would walk a few steps, bow down, and most commentators say this also would have included a prayer with each bow. So he's walking, he's bowing, he's praying. What do you think he's praying? He's praying, "Lord, don't let him kill me. Lord, don't let him take me out here and now." So he's walking, he's bowing, he's praying every step of the way. And then what happened? Well, before we resume with our reading, let me just say that I think we can all relate to Jacob's predicament. It's very easy to be an armchair quarterback, isn't it? You know, it's very easy on this side of Jacob's predicament to say, well, Jacob should have and could have done this. Jacob should have responded in a way that showed that he actually trusted in the Lord. But then you don't have to think too long about yourself. Think about all the scary situations you've been in. Think about all the times that you've worried, all the times that you've fretted, all the times that you've been fearful of one outcome that might just spell doom. I mean, we can relate to him, can we not? I'd be scared too. If I had done what he did to his brother, if I had done that to my brother, and then absented myself in fear for 20 years, and then come back, and now he's standing not too far off with 400 of his men, I'd be afraid as well, in my flesh. So again, we can all understand and relate to Jacob's predicament, even as believers. Our lives can be dramatically affected by things that frighten us, things that worry us, things that are built more on perception than they are rooted in reality. We know that we should trust in the Lord. We know that. And we know that whatever befalls us, as David wrote in Psalm 46:1, he who is our refuge and strength is both willing and able to serve as our ever-present help in our time of need. But knowing and doing are often two different things. We can still allow our fears to dictate how we act and respond to things. And I believe this is what Jacob was doing here. And yet note once again the goodness of God. How did Esau react? You know, I don't know about you, but I remember long ago when I first read this account, I was thinking, okay, here's where Jacob dies. I mean, I didn't know. I hadn't read the Bible before, but when I got to this chapter, I was really excited because really deep down inside, I kind of wanted Jacob to get it. After all the deception, after all the shenanigans that he had pulled, I mean, Jacob is not the quintessential example of godliness at this point. And in my naive understanding of things, I got to chapter 33 and I was like, okay, this is where Jacob gets it. This is where Jacob meets his end, and justifiably so. And then what I read shocked me to the core. It still shocks me, as a matter of fact. Read on with me at verse 4. Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him, and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And we know why Jacob was weeping. He'd been scared to death. You know, you ever been in a really scary situation? You know, dare I say, any of you been to a haunted house before or something like that, and you go to maybe Six Flags or something, you go to one of those scary rides, and you're little, and when you come out the other end, you're in tears because you survived. Right? We've all been there. Jacob's weeping because he survived. And not only that, he had to have been touched by the response of his brother. He knew what he deserved. He thought he knew what he would get. And yet, Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. He lifted his eyes and saw the women and the children, that is, Esau. And he said, who are these with you? So he said, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. Then the maids came near with their children and they bowed down. Leah likewise came near with her children and they bowed down. And afterward, Joseph came near with Rachel and they bowed down. And he said, what do you mean by all this company which I have met? And he said, to find favor in the sight of my Lord. But Esau said, I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own. Jacob said, no, please. If now I have found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. Please take my gift, which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty. Thus he urged him, and he took it. You know, in this passage, in Esau's response to his brother, we can actually learn a great deal about God himself. And this is where it's very important, as I always say, to slow down and ask ourselves, what can I glean from this passage by way of application that might help me understand not just what's going on in the immediate circumstances here, but how might I use this as a way of understanding God and His relationship to me? I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but understand first and foremost, I'm not saying that Esau was a godly man. He wasn't. I'm simply saying that in spite of who Esau really is, we can still see God's goodness coming through Esau in this instance. We see in Esau's love for his brother, God's love for us. Again, what did Jacob deserve? He deserved to be killed on the spot. Esau, at this point, is his superior in every way. And it's not just a perception that Jacob has. Jacob has his family and a whole lot of animals. Esau has 400 armed men. Most commentators say that Esau was likely with these 400 men, since he didn't bring them to kill Jacob, it's likely that he was coming back from a battle himself, and they just happened to meet at this particular juncture. Esau could have killed his brother. Esau, by all human standards, should have killed his brother for what he had done to him. Birthrights were big things. To disinherit him in that way, with all of that deception. Humanly speaking, again, Esau had every right to kill his brother Jacob. But God also has every right to put us to death. And yet He doesn't. Instead, as we see here, and this kind of mirrors the account of the prodigal son, the sovereign rushes out, and instead of killing the subordinate, the inferior one, He embraces him and kisses him. So again, we see God's goodness in that, despite the fact that Jacob didn't deserve Esau's blessing, in the same way we don't deserve God's blessing either. We see God's forgiveness. In spite of how poorly we've treated God, we see forgiveness here. Esau was willing to forgive his brother. That's astounding. This is what true forgiveness is. In addition to his forgiveness, we also see God's self-sufficiency. What does Esau say when presented with Jacob's gift? I don't need it. Neither does God need anything from us. God is not a needy God. God is a sovereign God. He owns the cattle on a thousand hills. He owns everything within the scope of His creation. He doesn't need anything from us. We see His grace in that He doesn't require anything from us in order to receive His blessing. And we see His willingness to receive our worship, even though He doesn't really need it. Esau should have and could have told Jacob, stop it. Stop with the groveling. Stop with all the Lord this and Lord that. Stop with all this servant language. But he doesn't do that, does he? No. He respects Jacob's admiration for him. He accepts it. And again, he's not a godly man. He's not the perfect picture of God. But we do see parallels here with our own God. God accepts the worship of an imperfect people. God accepts the worship that we give Him, even though He doesn't need it, even though He doesn't require it. Remember what Jesus said about the stones themselves. If we didn't praise God, if we didn't worship God, God could extract that same worship from the rocks. So He's not in need of it, but He accepts it. He accepts it because He's worthy of it. And from the picture drawn here for us, Esau is in very much every way, humanly speaking, worthy of Jacob's admiration. Remember, at this point, Jacob doesn't have much at all, does he? Jacob's inheritance is in Canaan, not where he's at right now. This is Edom. This is Esau's land. So Jacob is a man of really no means at this point. He's received the promise, but he's not yet settled in Canaan where all of these promises will eventually come true. Esau has amassed quite a fortune for himself. Esau was also promised all of those lands, remember? And Esau has benefited greatly already from those things. When Jacob says to Esau in verse 10, "I see your face as one sees the face of God," what does he mean? Well, many scholars believe that Jacob's simply expressing to his brother that he was approaching him with the same feelings of penitence as if he had been coming before God himself. He's also acknowledging, just as God does, that having come to him with a repentant spirit, sorry for what he had done, and I do believe Jacob was genuinely sorry, looking back on everything that he had done. He approaches him as if he would God himself, and just as God does, Esau showed him mercy. Now, it may in fact be true that Jacob himself saw God's mercy in Esau's response. But I still believe there was some little kernel of his trying to ingratiate himself to his brother just in the interest of self-preservation. We can't escape that. You know, it's not that, okay, now this encounter's happened and Esau's proven himself to be kind of a picture of God's goodness, and so Jacob is now whole again, and Jacob is holy, and now he's on the right track. I don't think that's true at all. I think there's still this little bit of Jacob left. The deceiver is still there. I think this is demonstrated in verse 11, where Jacob urged Esau, or insisted, that he accept his gift. What's that all about? I mean, you've seen how sizable the gift is. I mean, that's a lot of livestock. That's a considerable amount of money that he's willing to part with to ingratiate himself to his brother Esau. Esau says, "No, I don't need it. I don't want it." Now, if you have a brother or sister, you probably understand the dynamic that's going on here. In most cases, now that everything's been smoothed over, now that forgiveness has been extended, now that he's seen grace and mercy from his brother Esau, we might expect for Jacob to say, "Well, thank you for that. Thank you for that. I'll take the gift back if you don't really need it. Are you sure?" "Yes, I'm sure. I don't need it." "Okay, I'm going to take it all back." But he doesn't do that, does he? Instead, he insists that his brother take it. And you might think, "Oh, that's sweet. Jacob's such a nice guy." He's like, "No, really, take it. Because I love you so much." Is that what's going on here? No. No. Upon further inspection, there was a custom of that day that said that you didn't accept a gift from an enemy. So Jacob wanted to make sure that Esau was not still at odds with him. Esau would have refused altogether, outright. Even at Jacob's insistence, Esau still would have refused if he considered Jacob an enemy. The fact that he said okay and he took it indicated that they were no longer enemies. So there was an ulterior motive there, right? Anyway, after this reconciliation, we read in verse 12, "Then Esau said, 'Let us take our journey and go, and I will go before you.'" Now, you think the old Jacob's dead? You think he's worthy of the name Israel? You think that his deceiving days are over? Keep reading. "But he said to him, 'My Lord knows that the children are frail, that the flocks and herds which are nursing are a care to me, and if they're driven hard one day, all the flocks will die.'" You know, I wish I could really say what I think about that statement. It's just, it's nonsense. How do we know it's nonsense? Jacob has been running his flocks and his whole family as hard as they can go to get away from Laban. Right? And now when Esau says, hey, follow me back home to Seir. We'll go back home, have a great feast. We'll do all these wonderful things together. Jacob's like, no, it's going to be really hard on the children. It's going to be really hard on the livestock. Please let my Lord pass on before his servant, and I will proceed at my leisure, according to the pace of the cattle that are before me and according to the pace of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir. Esau said, please let me leave with you some of the people who are with me. But he said, what need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built for himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore the place is named Succoth. You see what's going on there? This is further proof that Jacob's the same old Jacob that he was before. Esau offers to escort Jacob, his family, his flocks, to Esau's home in Seir, but instead, Jacob politely refuses the offer, sharing with Esau that the Lord had directed him to return to Canaan would have been the correct answer, right? But he doesn't. What does he do? He says, oh, the kids are weak, they're getting grumpy, the livestock will never be able to follow your pace. Just go ahead. Go ahead and we'll be right behind you. Wink, wink. He lies. Once again, living up to his birth name. In case you're wondering where Seir was, this is a reference to the area around Mount Seir in Edom. You can look at this on your maps in the back of your Bibles if you have a map that shows Israel during the patriarchal period. Mount Seir was in Edom, which is just south and east of the Dead Sea. But where was Succoth, where Jacob built a house and made booths for his livestock? Succoth is north of the Dead Sea, halfway between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. How far is that away from Seir? It's 80 to 100 miles in the opposite direction. Now, in all fairness, some commentators are quick to come to Jacob's defense. They insist that, oh, well, he intended to go to Seir and got sidetracked along the way. Some commentators have even suggested that he actually did go to Seir, but we're just not told. Folks, I shouldn't have to tell you this. I probably don't have to tell you this, but that's a classic example of eisegesis. Not only is that speculation, but to want to protect Jacob so badly that you would make excuses for him and say, well, you know, he intended to go there. He wasn't lying. He was lying. He knew he was lying. Because again, as soon as Esau and his 400 men and all that he had with him had gotten out of sight, Jacob intentionally picked up and went the opposite direction. You get that? As soon as he could, he turned around, went back over the Jabbok, headed a few miles north to Succoth and settled there. How long was he there? Well, at least for a few years. He was there for at least a few years. In fact, the name Succoth is literally translated as temporary shelter. Some of you might be familiar with the annual Jewish feast of the same name. It's also known as the Feast of Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Booths. Every year in celebration of the children of Israel's deliverance from Egypt, where all along the way in the wilderness they would have to set up booths, tabernacles. This is in honor of that particular moment during their captivity. So what's so significant about Jacob's temporary home in Succoth? Well, as one commentator said, Succoth was a backward step, spiritually as well as geographically. It lies to the east of the Jordan River, thus outside the boundary of Canaan. Now, think about that. Where was Jacob instructed to go? To Canaan. Where was he expected to go immediately? To Canaan. Instead, he goes to Succoth, which is not in Canaan. And he stays there in a temporary dwelling for a few years. What does that constitute? Disobedience. And let me just share this for you children who might not be aware of the subtle nuances that are bound up in total obedience. What God requires of all of us, and children, this is what God requires of you in response to what your parents order you to do. God expects complete obedience. In our home growing up, Natalie knows this well, delayed obedience is disobedience. Partial obedience is disobedience. You understand that? On Jacob's part here, he was guilty of both. He was guilty of delayed obedience. Yeah, I'll make my way to Canaan, but on my terms, whenever I'm ready. Instead, I'm going to stop here, stay a few years. But it was also incomplete obedience. Had God's instructions not been clear? They had. Look back at chapter 31 and verse 3. Chapter 31, verse 3. The Lord had told Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you." 10 verses later, the Lord reiterates this command, saying, "I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me." Most scholars believe that this is God's way of reiterating to Jacob, "I need you to return to Canaan, and not just to Canaan, you need to go back to Bethel. You need to go back to Bethel where it all began." But Jacob doesn't do that, does he? Verse 18. "Now Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram and camped before the city." It was here in Shechem that Moses writes, "He bought the piece of land where he had pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money." Now, why does it say pieces of money? Because we don't really know what kind of money they used back then during this time frame or with this particular people. "Then he erected an altar and called it El Elohe Israel, which translated means God, the God of Israel, or to God, who is the God of Israel." You might remember this place from our study of Genesis chapter 12. If not, go ahead and turn back there. Genesis chapter 12. Why is this place significant? Why is it that Jacob chose to stay here? Well, in Genesis 12, verses 5 through 7, we read, "Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his nephew, and all their possessions which they had accumulated, and the persons which they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan. Thus they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. Now the Canaanite was then in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, 'To your descendants I will give this land.' So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him." So Jacob, no doubt knowing this, I mean, who was Abraham to Jacob? It was his grandfather. And so he had heard all the accounts. He knew well the lay of the land in this particular area. This would have probably been a welcome sight to him. And so he surmised that it was perfectly okay to settle here in Shechem. After all, he was in Canaan. Now, let me just ask you this. Is Shechem the name of the city in which Jacob settled, or is it the name of Hamor's son? Which is it? Yes. And what else do we know about this man named Shechem? Well, in the next chapter, we're going to learn more than we could ever hope to know about Shechem. So, read ahead. We're also going to see in that next chapter what I believe is God's dealing with Jacob in a very harsh way. Jacob is finally going to experience a form of judgment by the Lord for all that he had done up to this point. And again, it's let me just say this. Next week's message is going to be a little more PG than our lessons thus far. So I would encourage you, parents, if you have a child under the age of, well, it doesn't really matter. I mean, up to the age of 18, who has not been exposed to this kind of thing, study this with them this week. Explain it to them. I will be as gentle and as non-graphic as I can. But this is a hard chapter. Genesis chapter 34 is difficult. And it would go a long way if parents would help their children understand exactly what's going on. And not only that, I mean, I'm probably going to leave in their minds more questions than answers. I'm going to approach it, again, very gently. But just remind yourselves of what goes on there. And seek whatever you can learn, whatever you can glean from that passage. And see if we come to the same conclusions in our time next week. Just prepare your younger folks so that they won't be taken aback by it all. Well, before I close this morning, let me just leave you with a couple of applications that I think are important considering what we've looked at in our time together this morning. First of all, let me remind us all to be on guard relative to the tendency that we all have to resort to our flesh when problems arise. We all have this problem. We all have the problem of not seeking to involve God until things are out of hand. You know, we have this idea that we can handle things on our own. We have this idea that we are capable of dealing with certain things, given our own experiences, given our own maturity, and so on and so forth. Let your first instinct always be to take it to the Lord. Always. No matter how seemingly insignificant that thing might be, instead of trying to go it on your own, take it to the Lord. We need to develop a complete trust in God's sovereign care and provision for us, as well as resigning ourselves to the fact that whatever He ordains is right. Right? And let me just say this. Among each other, learn to be more trusting of each other. Right? There is never a cause for lying to each other. There's never a cause for deception. You understand that? Instead, learn to trust one another. Now, what does that imply about being the person to whom people entrust things? Well, you have to show yourself to be trustworthy, right? You have to show yourself to be worthy of being brought into the situation, where people can help you, people can pray for you. Let people carry your burdens with you. Love bears all things. Love believes all things. That's difficult, isn't it? Because we all have this sense of pride, and we don't want people to freak out when they hear about certain things that are going on in our lives. We just automatically place this wall of distrust there. I suppose that a lot of that distrust is actually a fear that they're going to say something you don't want to hear. Right? We need to get rid of that. I might not tell you what you want to hear, but I will assure you with every fiber of my being that I will always tell you what you need to hear. Right? More often than not, misery loves company. We confide in others because, you know, we kind of come alongside them because we know that they will agree with us. We know that they won't be hard on us. We know that they will get in the ditch with us. But let me just tell you this, as brothers and sisters in Christ, our mission is to pull one another out of ditches, not to jump in the ditch with them. You get that? I was asked not long ago if I believed in empathy. I don't believe in empathy. Why? I do believe very much in sympathy. Sympathy is my ability to come alongside you, and although I don't understand what you're going through, I know enough about the situation to be able to sympathize with you in what you are going through. Now, why don't I believe in empathy? Well, that ought to be fairly evident if you understand what empathy really means. Sympathy is my ability to feel what you're feeling without experiencing what you're experiencing, to carry your burden, to help you with that burden. Empathy is my pretending to know exactly what you're feeling. Somebody loses a parent. Empathy says, well, here's the first problem. Empathy always begins with the word I know how you feel because I lost a parent too. That might sound wonderful, right? It might sound very helpful. It's not. Why? You have no idea what it's like to be me. You have no idea. You can't put yourself in my shoes ever. You don't know what I'm struggling with. You don't know what's going on in here or in here. And so to pretend, empathy pretends to know and be able to engage with that person on that the deepest level, as if I am now you. I will never insult you to that level. I don't know what it's like to walk in your shoes. I'll tell you right now, I have no idea what it's like to live your life. And I'll never pretend to. What I will do, though, I will extend sympathy to you. I will tell you, I can only imagine the pain you're feeling. And I don't like it. I feel for you. Not as you. You understand that? Some people might say, well, that's, yeah, you're kind of splitting hairs here. That's really not a distinction that I'm interested in making. Well, you should be. Because again, the moment you pretend to assume one's role as them, you've overstepped. You've jumped in the ditch with them. When I'm miserable, when I'm going through various trials, when I'm experiencing various heartbreaks and worries, and I don't need you in the ditch with me. I need you outside the ditch with your arm down here saying, pull. Right? You understand the difference? you jump down the ditch with me, chances are we're both going to fight for survival. And it won't be pretty. So that's the first application here. Don't resort to your flesh to solve your problems. Go to the Lord. And then go to one another and enlist the help of the Lord together. Showing compassion, showing sympathy, carrying one another's burdens, so on and so forth. Jacob didn't do that. At every step, and let's be honest, Jacob comes by it honestly, doesn't he? I mean, look at Abraham. Look at Isaac. Look at Rebekah. Jacob learned early on to try to handle things on his own. And again, as I said, next week we're going to find out where that really didn't bode well for him. Had he trusted all along that God would protect him, that God would preserve him, that God would take him to the land that he had promised him, he could have just done it all with the greatest of ease. Instead, he resorted to his own means, and look what happened. Well, secondly, don't just seek God's protection. Seek His direction as well. Now, what does that mean? Well, Jacob arrived at his final destination as a result of God's protection. But we never see him asking for God's direction. Again, let me clarify that. It's not enough that we enjoy God's protection wherever we decide to put down roots, or whether when we decide to transplant ourselves from one place to another. You know, God continues protecting us, providing for us. What's most important is that wherever we find ourselves, we're there because we first sought the Lord's direction. You know, you can remove a lot of God's necessary protection if you'll just first follow His direction. The reason we so often need God's protection is because we've not first sought His direction. You understand that? Jacob needed God's protection because Jacob was a knucklehead. Had he only sought the direction that God wanted him to go and then followed that, he would not have needed His protection nearly as much. As we go through our study next Lord's Day, again, I want you to think about whether everything that happened in Jacob's life in chapter 34 might have been avoided had he asked for God's direction versus simply taking for granted His protection. Now, how do I know that that's probably true? Now, of course, please don't come up to me afterwards and say, nope, what happened happened because whatever God ordains is right. He ordained it all and that's what happened. Okay, I get that. But again, there's also an element to every one of our lives involving the decisions we make, involving how much we involve God in the direction of our lives instead of just the protection in our lives. Jacob ended up in Shechem. Had he gone to Bethel instead, chapter 34 never would have happened. Could chapter 34 be the direct result of Jacob's disobedience? Could be. Right? You know, it's perfectly fine, again, to view the sovereignty of God in all of its splendor and to see that everything that happens, happens because God has ordained it to come to pass. That's wonderful. But you cannot divorce that from the reality that we're involved too. How do we understand that? I don't understand that. But I do know that there's a whole lot of cause and effect that we're learning about here. Man does something that elicits the judgment, the wrath, the punishment, the chastisement of God, whereas if he had avoided that thing, that never would have happened. You get that? Don't ask me how we make sense of it. I can't. Because at the end of the day, God still ordained that, whatever came to pass. Still very much a sense in which we can all avoid God's chastisement if we'll only pay more attention to being more observant and obedient. Is that not what we're told throughout the Scriptures? It is. If you'll obey, you'll receive blessing. If you don't, you'll be chastised. Again, how does that work in the grand scheme of things? I don't know. So, well, I'm going to leave it there. Again, parents, cover that next chapter with your kids. I would say even with your teens. Ask them if they know what's going on there. And if they don't, I trust that the Lord will give you the words to explain it. So, come prepared for our next study, Lord willing, as we pick up at chapter 34.